Good evening. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Friday, May 11th, 2018. The time is 6:30 p.m. If you're joining us off net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, the state capitol, fifth floor, room 532. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this evening, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good evening, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
Good evening, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good to be here.
Senator Michicki.
Good evening, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Good evening, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good evening, Madam Chair.
Senators, thank you for being here this evening to work on Alaska's business. On today's agenda, we have two items, HB 79, workers' compensation, and HB 119, ADA dividend income value projects. We are still waiting for a CS on 119, but we are going to, after we have 79, start into HB 119 to understand the components of what came from the other body. If I could direct members' attention to HB 79, the Omnibus Workers' Compensation Bill. We heard this bill on April 12, 2018, and again on April 13th. The bill presentation was taken. The public hearing was opened and closed. Senator Bishop, may I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move committee substitute for House Bill 79, version 30-GH 1789/echo before the committee is our working document.
I'll object to understand the changes. Ms. Lucky, if you could state your name for the record and then walk us through the mechanics of the bill before us.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Julie Lucky, and I am staff to Senator McKinnon. You should have in front of you, along with the Senate CS version E, an explanation of changes and a revised sectional. The bill itself, as the committee may remember, was fairly long. The changes in the CS, most of them were actually removals from the bill. If you look at the explanation of changes, the items that are remaining in the bill are ensuring adequate funding, reducing administrative costs, and keeping in the definition of independent contractors. The only change addition to the CS is to add a legislative workers' compensation working group, and that change can be found starting on page 12, line 10. It's a new section 23. One of the difficulties that the committee was having with the bill was there were some concern about making sure that the bill was balanced and whether some of the items in the bill were efficiencies or reforms. There was legislative intent to have a little bit more conversation about this over the interim and hope to bring some of the issues that have been removed from the bill back in front of the next legislature. So section 23 would put forth a legislative workers' compensation working group to be made up of six members of the legislature, three from the House and three from the Senate. They would consult with representatives of the following stakeholders, and that would be the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Medical Services Review Committee established under AS 2330-095J, organized labor, school district administrators, and the state's business community. The goal of the legislative task force would be to recommend improvements to the laws relating to workers' compensation and put forth a report, and I believe the report is due, and if you look on page 13, line 5, on or before December 1st, 2018, and the intent is to ensure that there's adequate time for review and to put forth legislation in front of the next legislature. And I'm, if the committee would like me to, I can go through a sectional. I know that originally the sectional was fairly long, but what I did try to provide so that the committee could see what was in and out is if you look at the explanation of changes, all of the sections of the original bill are there, and there's a strike-through for the items that were taken out and renumbering for all of the sections that remain in the bill.
Would and the committee like a new sectional analysis? I think we're good, Ms. Lucky.
And for the committee's information, I have checked with the departments, and this would not, because the electronic filing, the EDI is still in, and the second injury fund is still repealed, there is no change to the fiscal notes. Those are the items that caused the fiscal notes in originally.
With that explanation, I'll withdraw my objection to the adoption of the Senate CS for the CS for House Bill number 79, version E. Is there further objection to adopting the CS? Seeing none, brief at ease. We have the Senate CS for House Bill 79, version E, posted online. If I can invite Commissioner Dragas to the microphone. Commissioner, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
First, I want to thank the other body, as well as you, for all of the work that has been done on the workers' comp issue. And certainly the bill before us is a trimmed-down version of the expectations both of your body, being the administration, and the other body. This is what we could come up with to try to streamline services on behalf of the department and move that draft forward. Would you like to provide comments to the committee? There is a working group in there. It is our intention to try to put our shoulder to the grindstone and try to make sure that policymakers are at the table as we listen to employees' needs and employers' needs and try to hammer out a proposal that we can get elected officials bought in on. We have multiple pieces of legislation that are important to workers. We saw many things that we supported, but we heard also that there were many things from an employer side of the house that they wanted us to hold up on to balance before we accommodated some of the administration's requests. So your comments for the CS in front of us, understanding that this is not your ideal package. We understand that.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Heidi Dragas. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. First, I'd like to thank the committee for taking up this bill. I do know that we had lofty ambitions with our bill. It was a big bill. As we have said many times before, both me and Director Marie Marks of the Division of Workers' Compensation, it was an efficiencies bill. There are items that left in the CS that we do appreciate. The funding for the division is greatly appreciated, electronic filing, the independent contractor definition. So there are some very good things that this bill will accomplish. There are several things that were left out that I do believe would make our division run better, that I would consider good government provisions. My hope is that this working group can take those up this summer. There has been a lengthy conversation between labor and industry about addressing substantive benefits in the interim, and I think that is an important thing to address, and I think that the stakeholders are the best groups, and not the department really, to address those issues, bringing folks from industry, folks from organized labor together to address those issues. I think that's long overdue. And so I am eager to see how the working group comes together. The department stands ready to assist in that endeavor. I think we've got them a good start with a lot of the provisions from our bill. And so somewhat begrudgingly, we do support the CS and the provisions that you did leave in.
Commissioner, thank you for those comments. And we do understand. I think of the bills that I've tried to carry. I'll do the one tongue-in-cheek that I had to on eliminating daylight saving time. You know, it was a six-year run, and it's still not eliminated. And I still am the champion of that cause, per se, from Alaskans who email me and ask me about that. I know Senator Olson has tried to do that before too, and so we're late in the game to receive the bill, and this is the best that we could do to support all the work that has been done around the workers' comp issue. And I do truly believe that if we can get some elected officials to hear both sides of the proposals, that they can balance those and then bring something to the legislative bodies that we can actually support and move through. Representative Josephson brought a compelling case for 18 years in the making of folks that have not seen an increase to damages when they are injured. This committee supports those things. But there was a conversation with the business community, still even after the compromise language that you work with the Chamber of Commerce and that working group, that they still were saying that if we gave something, then they weren't getting something. And we just really feel like we need to understand the ins and outs of the issue. And I have confidence in legislators to be able to sit down and hear that and then come in and with the administration support something to move through this body. Senator Machicki? Comments from committee members. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure who to address this to, whether it's to the commissioner or somebody else or whoever the idea was to have the working group. Since I've been here for a period of time, there have been task forces and working groups, and especially with this year, with the election year going on and people in close races and whatever else, I guess I'm somewhat how do you help my pessimism of trying to get something done for these monumental type of things that have caused the tension between employers and employees from a long time back?
Through the co-chair, Senator Olson, the language did not come from the department, so I couldn't really speak to the language, but we have reviewed it. I am aware that it is an election year, so I think work during the interim might be difficult. That said, I'm hopeful. Years ago in the 80s and in the 90s, the workers' compensation community, I guess I'll say, had a group called the Ad Hoc Committee, the Workers' Comp Ad Hoc Committee. It was equal members of organized labor and industry that came together, the stakeholders that really need to be at the table to discuss substantive benefits and reform to workers' compensation. And my understanding is that that committee worked very well together for many years. And my hope is that we can revive that committee. It was not something that was born of the department, and I think that was part of its intention. It really needs to come from the stakeholders that want to see reform. As far as the department is concerned, substantive benefits is an important thing to address, but that's something that really comes from the stakeholders, not from the department. But as Co-Chair McKinnon mentioned, it's been 18 years since substantive benefits have been increased for workers. So I do think it's something that's worthwhile to tackle. Whether it can be done this interim, I hope so, but I guess that remains to be seen.
Senator Olson, if I could, sure. That concept came from my office. We put together a working group on reducing sexual assault. We implemented every single one of those recommendations in the time I've been here. We put together the oil and gas, and we have started to implement the recommendations from the oil and gas working group. And the idea was that it would be a legislative committee that would bring the folks that the commissioner is talking about to the table to actually share their perspectives and then have the elected officials be able to implement, to make a decision, because what's happening is it gets very political when it gets in this room and at this table where people are pulling and pushing, and we have to find some unity to actually protect workers better and to provide balance for employers. And so if you're elected, that's our job. We need to get there. And I am committed. I will volunteer to try to shepherd something through if my president sees fit with that, so that we can go forward and do that over the interim and make it a successful project. There are others, I believe, that will volunteer. And so there may be too many for me to serve, but that's where it came from. Senator Olson, follow up.
With all due respect, Commissioner, the Ad Hoc Committee, I understand, threw up its arms in frustration after they came up with their recommendations because they were really listened to. Is that true?
Through the co-chair, Senator Olson, I mean, I can't say what really happened. It was before my time. I think for many years it worked very, very well. My understanding is that when there were recommendations made and when legislation comes through that on workers' comp that didn't come through the ad hoc committee. I think that's that. I suspect that's what halted the ad hoc committee's work. If they were working hard on legislation that wasn't going to then be heard. But again, that was long before my time with the
department. No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Other questions from committee members? Commissioner, thank you so much for joining us today, and I apologize to all of those who are following this issue. I know it's very important, and we are trying to get our business done, and we're just in meetings all day long right now. Other comments? Do we need to cover the fiscal nets? Senator Bishop.
I had a deja vu moment. I thought we covered them, but already, ma'am, looking at my notes, but I can go over them again briefly at a high level if the committee wants to do that.
Please, I show on mine, and I could have been out of the room, but I don't show the fiscal number.
Well, I'll go with the chair. I'll follow the chair.
It's always good to cover it twice.
Department of Administration Risk Management OMB component number 71. It's $40,000 in the first year, $12,900 in the out years. And the bill will have a financial impact on the Division of Risk Management. It would clarify, amend, add, and repeal statutes within workers' compensation. Changes will impact the Division of Risk Management and include reporting changes to the Work Comp Board. The board will move from a manual process to electronic data input. With changes, appropriate forms for reporting. The electronic data import form submittals are through a third-party vendor at a cost of $1.25 per form, and the Division of Risk Management receives about 1,900 of these reports from the state workers a year, and approximately 1,200 of those forms turn into compensable claims. Each claim can generate approximately 8 forms. So Department of Risk Management anticipates $40,000 for the initial implementation and $12,900 in the out years for the day-to-day cost. Fiscal note number 344, that's through the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And workers' compensation, allocation to workers' compensation, OMB components 344. And you'll see a fund source from UGF decrement to DGF. A wash there. That's the increase in the WISCA account increase from 1.85 to up to the 2.5%, and that money will be deposited into the WISCA account. That money does not add, that increase does not add to any claims, any premiums from any employers. That was already, that 2.7 is already built into what the Division of Insurance collects, and we're within the target range there for funding. So that's about the nuts and bolts of that one. Department of Labor, Workforce Development, Work Comp, Second Injury Fund, OMB component 2432. You'll see a decrement going out 2020 through $800,000 in 2021, and through the out years, in it increases by $1,600. And so this legislation will sunset. This legislation is going to sunset the Second Injury Fund. Future claim payments will only be made on those claims accepted by the effective date. There will be no reduction in the near future in the staffing required to process because it will likely take decades for the fund to pay these ongoing claim obligations. 95% of those claims are categorized as permanent total disability benefits, and they are paid until disability ends or until near death. And the reason that this Second Injury Fund is sunsetting is because it's no longer legal to ask an employee if they have a disability. That's why the fund was set up in the first place. It's no longer legal to do that, so that's why the department is able to go forward and sunset this fund. The Second Injury Fund comes through an annual assessment on the work comp insurance, and providers and self-insured employers through a contribution rate that changes every year based on the statute. And in 2017, the state of Alaska compromised 11.5% of the total revenue, $343,150, of which $2,984,000 the state of Alaska could save as much as $46,000 if it represented 11.5% of projected total savings of $400,000 starting in 2020. And this savings will grow incrementally in the following years. Lastly, the cost savings will be passed on to all state agencies through decreased personal services benefit costs included in the future year budget salary and benefits adjustment.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Brief at ease. Back on the record. Is there any questions on the fiscal note? We do have Maria Marks in the audience if you have questions. Are we ready to move the bill? Senator Bishop.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Finance Committee substitute for House Bill 79, version 30-GH1789/echo from the committee with the accompanying fiscal notes and committee recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, the Senate CS for the CS for House Bill 79, version E, with attached fiscal notes and individual committee recommendations, moves from committee. Brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. We're back on the record. If I could direct the committee's attention to House Bill 119, Finance, version J is what we have before us. We heard the companion bill, SB 57, on March 2nd, 2017. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Mr. Parody, could you join us at the microphone? Mr. Parody, if you could give us an overview of what's before us from your perspective.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Parody. I'm the Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and I've served as the Commissioner's delegee to the ADA and AEA boards for the past 3.5 years. I think that the bill before you, major pieces of this are familiar from other bills that have been coming through in the last 2 years. House Bill 119 itself specifically addresses concerns that the ADA board has with two issues in accounting for purposes of the dividend calculation for the subsequent payment to the state. The first problem is mark-to-market valuation adjustments. Under current GASB rules, we're required to estimate the value of an asset on a particular day and book an adjustment as if we had sold it, when in fact we haven't sold it and it's still an investment that we're sustaining. That inflated or deflated valuation subsequently impacts the dividend calculation. The solution that's contained in the bill is to back those non-cash adjustments out of income before calculation of the ADA dividend payment and essentially return the dividend calculation to real net income. The second problem is that there is an ADA dividend penalty that's triggered by non-ADA-based project funding. In 2002, the legislature instructed ADA to disregard project funding from non-ADA sources when calculating the dividend so as to not artificially inflate net income. That legislation didn't account for circumstances when a project using non-ADA funds might be canceled and expenditures to date are written off. Without correction, those periodic adjustments could artificially decrease ADA net income. The solution is the same as for problem one, which is to back out losses for projects funded from sources outside the ADA revenue stream and return the dividend calculation to real net income. ADA has paid dividends to the state of approximately $380 million since the early 1990s, and we are working strongly to continue to do so. Passage of House Bill 119, or the committee substitute when it comes before you, will make the yearly dividend amount more predictable for your planning purposes as well as ours. The second topic that's in the bill is the extension of the reestablishment of the Red Dog Port and Transportation Valuation Exemption. The language clarifies and reinstitutes the property tax exemption for the Red Dog Port and the DeLong Mountain Transportation System. That exemption was implemented for that infrastructure in the early 2000s, but it sunset in November of 2017. The language also clarifies that the exemption applies to the ADA-owned port. It was always assumed to, but there was a reinterpretation such that we want to make sure the mine and the port are treated as a unit and are excluded from taxation. Reinstitution of that exemption is retroactive in the bill to November of 2017 to make that extension seamless for the Red Dog Mine. That's when it expired. In the revised fiscal note for HB 119 does not show an increase in state education aid for the Red Dog Mine because the funds are already contained in the base education budget and would continue to be so in the continuing years. Although the Northwest Arctic Borough does not levy a property tax, TEC makes payments to the borough through a negotiated PILT. That PILT agreement has been renegotiated and is increasing to between $14 and $18 million a year. And in the current year, the Northwest Arctic Borough appropriated $4 million to its school district, which exceeds any required local contribution. The third piece of the bill concerns the Ketchikan Shipyard Valuation Exemption. It clarifies that the property tax exemption applies to the Ketchikan Shipyard, which is owned by ADA. From 1997 until 2012, the shipyard was considered to be covered by the existing statutory property tax exemption. In 2012, the state assessor's office ruled that the possessory interest, I've been working on that pronunciation, possessory interest, of the agreement with ADA did not qualify for the mandatory exemption. The effect under the required local contribution of that change, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough has been paying an increased local contribution to education for a number of years, including the shipyard in that mandatory exemption, will require approximately $79,000 of increased education funding starting in fiscal year 2020. Madam Chairman, I am unclear if you, there's a fourth item, which is the IEP bond exception, which was before you in a Senate Bill 125, which I believe is familiar. It's in the committee substitute, but not in 119, and I don't know whether you want me to quickly touch on it or wait.
If you could hold there for a moment. Senator Bishop, can I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the committee substitute for House Bill 119, version 30-GH1677, / uniform before the committee as our working document.
I'll object. To understand what's before us, we're at the end of session. There is a title available for the public that's following at home, and so what has been happening on this particular bill, if it was a holiday season, it would be called a Christmas tree, and that is that other projects that or other bills that are in various stages around the building, if they qualify, are trying to attach to this bill to move in front of the Senate for consideration. So I apologize for any confusion in what is going on today, but I'm trying to get to the public hearing where all of it is on the table at once. Ms. Lucky, if you could walk us through the changes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Julie Lucky, and I am staff to Senator McKinnon. You should have in front of you the CS version U and hopefully an explanation of changes document that doesn't have too many typos. I will briefly go through the explanation of changes and try as best as I can to go through a sectional of the bill for the committee. The explanation of changes are there is additional language added to AS 4240-350 that states the Alaska Railroad Corporation does not have authority over any right, title, or interest in property transferred under this subsection that was not vested in the United States at the time of transfer. And that is in Section 3 of the bill. Senator McKinnon, would you prefer that I go through a sectional and mark out which and note which sections are new, or would you prefer I go through the changes? It'll be a little bit, I'm not sure how the committee would prefer to go through this.
Ms. Lucky, I remember the ADA bill. Whatever is your pleasure.
So I think it might be a little less confusing to go through the bill in front of us as a sectional, and I'll point out which ones are the new sections. Section 1 of the bill, starting on page 2, is was currently in House Bill 118 as Section 1, which has to do with the tax assessment that Mr. Parity just talked about with the, I believe it's both the Red Dog Pilt and the Ketchikan Shipyard in one section. Section 2 would be the sunset for those same provisions. So you'll see that same language being taken out, and the effective date for Section 2 would be November 30th of 2027, and that was in the existing House Bill 119 as it came to the committee. Section 3 of the bill, which starts on page 6, line 20, is actually a technical change that is made necessary by the inclusion of Section 6. Section 4 was what I was just referencing. This is a new section that came in from a bill related to railroad land disposals, and it has to do with railroad ownership for corporations, and I believe Representative Kopp is here and can speak more specifically to what that language would entail. Section 5 will hopefully be familiar to the Senate Finance Committee. This was a provision put into the bill regarding railroad real property transfers, as the bill was in front of us, that requires notification by registered mail to adjacent landowners when the railroad is going to be transferring or selling real property. Section 6 is also new language regarding the interest in land that Representative Kopp will be able to explain a little bit more fully. Section 7 should also be familiar to the committee. This removes some bond authority. This was put into the bill related to railroad property disposals as it was in front of the committee. And that would be Sections 7 and 8, and this was removing bond authority that is no longer needed and unused that was in those statutes. Section 9 of the bill correlates with Section 3 of the bill as it came in front of you with House Bill 119, and that was the mark-to-market calculations. Section 10 was also in from the House Bill 119 as it came to us, as was Section 11, which has the definitions for that mark-to-market and project and developments. Section 12 of the bill was what Mr. Parity was about to explain about the IEP, and that extends the authorization to issue bonds until June 30th, 2023. If the bill were not to pass, that authorization would sunset June 30th of this year. Section 13 and Section 14, again, are removing that unneeded and unnecessary bond authority, which Senate Finance had passed out in the bill related to Alaska Railroad land transfers. Sections 15, I'll back up just a little bit. As the committee may remember, when we saw the bill related to railroad land transfers, what passed out of Senate Finance was an authority for the corporation to sell land without legislative approval. Changes in the other body had to deal with, instead of giving them a blanket authority, it just put in certain projects that they would have the authority for. And Sections 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22 are all various projects that they had wanted the authority to dispose of their interest in the real estate. And I believe that Ms. Reneva Moss from Senator Coghill's office can explain those projects more fully. Section 23 is a reporting requirement. As the committee may remember, when we heard the bill regarding the railroad land transfers, this was a new area for them to be able to sell this land, and there was a reporting requirement put on there so that the legislature could understand how that was working to sell that land for commercial interests. Section 24 is a retroactivity section, which goes back to Section 1, which I believe is the tax assessment of November 30th, 2017. That was in the existing House Bill 119 as it came to us. Section 25 is an immediate effective date for the rest of the bill. And then Section 26 is the delayed effective date of November 30th, 2027 for Section 2, which was the repeal of those tax assessment sections. And that is the end of the CS, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee on the structure of the bill? Seeing and hearing that, I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to the Senate CS for the CS for House Bill 119, Version U? Seeing and hearing none, Version U is adopted and before the body. Deputy Commissioner Parity, would you like to talk to us briefly on the high overview on the IEP? It's now in front of us.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. The Interior Energy Project bond authorization is to extend the bond authorization for a five-year period. It simply allows ADA to, in working in conjunction locally with IGU, the Interior Gas Utility, to access bond financing. There's no other change to the bond financing previously authorized, and I would note that the project is underway. The construction is ongoing as we speak of the new 5 million gallon liquefied natural gas storage tank.
Thank you. Other questions for the Deputy Commissioner? Thank you. I'd like to invite Heather Carpenter, staff to Senator Kelly. Carpenter, if you could direct us to your section of the bill and then walk us through why it should be under consideration by Senate Finance.
Madam Chair, for the record, Heather Carpenter, staff to Senator Kelly. The IEP, or the Interior Energy Project piece that was originally in Senate Bill 125, is now in Section 12 of the CS in front of you. That is starts on page 9, the very last line, and then continues on to page 10. The CS now includes the language from Senate Bill 125, version U. It extends the allowable time for the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority, or AIDA, to issue bonds for the Interior Energy Project by 5 years to June 30th, 2023. The Senate Finance Committee heard this version of the legislation on February 12th, 2018, and passed it out of committee on February 16th. Previous to that, the Community and Regional Affairs also heard the legislation and passed it out of committee. Senate Bill 125 then passed the Senate on February 21st by a vote of 19-0. As you know, the Interior suffers from the most volatile energy cost of any community on the rail belt. As a result of the cold winters and high energy prices, residents also burn a lot of wood and coal, exacerbating the high prices and air quality issues. While there was an existing gas distribution system in Fairbanks, it never exceeded more than 70 miles of pipe and never served more than about 1,200 customers. The lack of sufficient local backup of LNG storage prevented the addition of new residential customers who cannot afford to be interruptible during the cold winter. It is due to these issues that residents, the legislature, and then Governor Parnell put a package together in the form of Senate Bill 23, creating the Interior Energy Project to expand the availability of clean and affordable natural gas in the greater Fairbanks and North Pole areas. And that legislation passed in 2013. The funding package for the IEP included $57.5 million in a capital grant, all of which has been spent or obligated, $125 million in SET loans, and that stands for Sustainable Energy Transmission and Supply, of which $52.8 million has been expended and $45.5 million has been obligated, and $150 million in AIDA bonding authority, which is the subject of this section that is now included in House Bill 119. Madam Chair, the AIDA team overseeing the IEP has been diligently deploying the original finance package to advance development of a consolidated investment-grade local natural gas utility. Unfortunately, this authorization for the critical $150 million bond component is set to expire June 30th of this year before it can be used. The bonding is necessary for increasing the production capacity of the LNG plant at Point McKenzie and further expansion of the gas distribution network in the interior as economies of scale are developed. In the past several years, the IEP has had many notable accomplishments. It has had build-out of natural gas distribution system covering nearly all of the Fairbanks and Core North Pole, the passage last spring of the PACE legislation, which stands for Property Assessed Clean Energy, which was sponsored by Representative Wohl to assist in commercial conversion to natural gas, the securing of a gas supply agreement with Hillcorp, and the adoption of a qualified plan of development for the rest of the project in September. In December, the signing of agreements happened to consolidate the Fairbanks Natural Gas and the Interior Gas Utility Systems into a single investment-grade utility through the sale of Pentec's assets to IGU. And in January, construction began on a large-scale 5.2 million-gallon LNG storage facility in South Fairbanks that will support the future customer growth of a combined utility system. On its present schedule, FIRST expanded gas availability with the potential to first transition current interruptible customers to a firm service is expected in the winter of 2019. The construction season of 2020 will see the first full-scale efforts to convert properties with access to the existing distribution system to gas. Madam Chair, extending the sunset for AIDA's bonding authority for this project will ensure continued success of the IEP, and Senator Kelly's community will realize the vision of clean and affordable natural gas in the Fairbanks and North Pole area. And I apologize for following my notes more than normal. Joe Burns in our office normally carries this piece of legislation, and he had to return to Fairbanks.
Are there questions on the IEP extension from June 30th, 2018 to July 1st, 2023 for extending bond authority. Thank you. Mr. Lincoln, Representative Lincoln, I would like to invite you to the table. Your name for the record, if you could point to the sections of the bill that affect, I'm guessing, the Red Dog area.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, John Lincoln, representative for House District 40. The piece of this legislation that is especially relevant to the Northwest Arctic is Section 1. That section clarifies and reauthorizes a property tax assessment exemption for the DeLong Mountain Transportation System. This exemption was implemented in the early 2000s, reauthorized in 2012, and just expired last November. The Northwest Arctic Borough does not have a property tax and likely won't for a very, very long time, if ever. Much of the property in the borough is tax exempt for federal law. And the region also already struggles economically with high costs and low employment. A property tax there would result in significant inequities between those residents who happen to live in on property that is tax exempt and those that do not. And despite not having a property tax in our borough, the state of Alaska partially sets the state's funding for a school district and a municipality's minimum local contribution based on an estimate of what a hypothetical property tax would generate in revenue. The DMTS, being a tax-exempt state-owned asset, cannot be taxed to recoup the cost despite its owner, ADA, receiving tens of millions of dollars a year from the use of that that facility. The exemption, as mentioned earlier, would be retroactive to last November to provide a seamless extension for the facility, with sunset in November 30, 2027. The fiscal note associated with House Bill 119 does not show a change relative to the DMTS, because the bill maintains a decades-long status quo. Funds are already budgeted and the base education budget, and would also be expected to be maintained in future years. I think that wraps up in summary.
Senator Bishop.
Madam Chair, Representative Lincoln, thank you for your overview, but correct me if I'm wrong, just for those listening at home, DMTS, the Long Mountain Transportation System?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Are there questions on the Red Dog project? Representative Lincoln, thank you for joining us in Senate Finance today.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz, join us at the microphone. Point to the sections that are relevant to your community, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Ortiz. I represent District 36, Southern Southeast Alaska, including the community of Ketchikan. Madam Chair, the Ketchikan portion of the bill before you is also found in Section 1, and the Ketchikan Shipyard portion of the bill, Madam Chair, will clarify the question of whether the perceived value of Vigor Alaska's long-term operating agreement for use of the ADA-owned tax-exempt property should be included in the state's calculation of the Ketchikan Gateway Borough's required minimum local contribution to school. To schools. Madam Chair, as Deputy Commissioner Parody had explained, when ADA took control of the shipyard in 1997, there was an exemption as a part of the agreement for ADA's ownership of the shipyard. That exemption lasted until 2012, and as Commissioner Parody explained, the state assessors put a different calculation forward at that point. And what we're trying to do with this bill, Madam Chair, is to reestablish that exemption based on the idea that it is an ADA-owned property, a state-owned property, and it's part of the overall initial operating agreement that was put forward when ADA took ownership and took over ownership in 1997.
Madam Chair, just a little bit more information about what happens down in Ketchikan at the shipyard. The shipyard's primary role today is to service, repair, and build replacement vessels for the Alaska Marine Highway ferry system. ADA owns the shipyard, and Vigor Alaska currently operates the facility under a 10-year contract with ADA. The agreement expires in 2025 and may be extended to 2035. The ADA story in Ketchikan is a successful story. The shipyard employs 226 workers at an average salary of $80,000 a year. It serves a necessary purpose within the state. It does a good job of recruiting workers from around the state. They work in cooperation with Northern Industrial Training in Anchorage, the Alaska Native Corporations, high schools around the state, AFTEC and Seward, and regional training centers as part of workforce development and recruitment. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm open to questions.
Representative Mortez, I'm going to throw you a softball. I hope you can receive it. Under invited testimony, did you request me to ask Mr. Glenn Brown to speak on this issue?
It's my understanding that Mr. Brown is ready to go, Madam Chair.
Home runs.
Thank you.
Mr. Brown, your name for the record, and then please proceed with brief comments on this project. Mr. Glenn Brown.
If you may, good evening, Senators. I appreciate the opportunity to address following Representative Ortiz. I won't belabor the points that he made. He fairly represented our concerns here in Ketchikan. There are a couple notes that I'd like to add to his comments, one being that the exemption that was in place, it was longstanding, 97 to 2012. During the interim, the operating agreement that is now in place was negotiated in 2005. That was premised on, as the representative said, up to 30-year term, with the understanding that the mandatory exemption was in place. It was only by virtue of a change in the state assessor's view of the shipyard that brought about our full assessment value increasing by $74 million for the community. That impacts our required local contribution significantly. At the time, the impact was $196,000 a year, excuse me, through some litigation and settlement. The impact at this point is the $79,000 a year that's reflected in the fiscal impact statement. The other points that I'd like to stress is that the commonality between the Long Mountain and the shipyard are poignant here in that they are both under operating agreements. They are not leased simply by ADA. They're operating agreements with ADA and the operators in Ketchikan. As noted, they primarily serve as a maintenance facility for the Marine Highway. They are subject to significant competition from shipyards south in Washington and Oregon. So their opportunity, while they have revenue-sharing provisions just like the Long Mountain does, it's only recently that the shipyard has begun to produce profits. That's a great sign of hope for us in Ketchikan, the workforce here, and what it means to our community. So I really would hope that the senators would consider this exemption. It is important to our town and to our shipyard. And I'll conclude my comments with that.
Mr. Brown, thank you for testifying before Senate Finance today. Are there questions from committee members from the Ketchikan Gateway Borough? Thank you, Mr. Brown, for testifying before Senate Finance. Thank you, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Senator.
I'd like to invite Reneva Moss, staff, to Senator Coghill. I am trying to take these in sections of the different projects. Representative Kopp, thank you for joining us. I'm just trying to get the stage set appropriately for going over the information. Welcome to Senate Finance. Ms. Moss, your name for the record, and then please proceed to tell the committee what is in here that is of interest to Fairbanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Reneva Moss, staff to Senator Coghill. The properties that will be sold by the railroad begin in Section 15 on page 10, line 9. Section 15 is a land swap and perhaps exchange of cash, depending on the valuation of both properties, between a Klutna Native Corporation and the Alaska Railroad. It involves a swap because Aklutna would like to acquire property owned by the Alaska Railroad to develop a gravel excavation operation and other development in conjunction with adjacent land already owned by Aklutna. In return, they would be swapping land in Birchwood that is adjacent to land already owned by the Alaska Railroad Corporation. In Section 16, the railroad would sell approximately 20 acres of land to the municipality of Anchorage for $1.5 million and the termination of a 102-acre long-term lease, freeing up over 80 acres to revert back to the railroad's operations at the port facility. The municipality is wishing to obtain title to allow expansion of the port facilities. Section 17 sells land to the Usabelli coal mine. In the early days of the Usabelli coal mine, housing was provided for workers at the mine camp, but as the camp grew, so did the miners' families. For safety reasons, the federal government told Usabelli to move the families off the mine property. The problem, however, was that most of the land in the surrounding area was owned by the Alaska Railroad. As a solution, the railroad leased Usabelli property to provide residential and related infrastructure, including schools, community center, churches, etc. Usabelli subleases the land to homeowners, as well as organizations like the Denali Borough, churches, daycare. If Usabelli has the opportunity to purchase the Tri-Valley subdivision land, it will then go through a process to make the lots available for purchase by current subleases. Section 18 is a two-phase subdivision near the Best Western Pioneer Park Inn across the Chena River from Carlson Center. Phase one has already been subdivided and developed with roads. It is up for sale. It includes the development of 23 lots into residential housing, and there is already a sale of four lots pending with earnest money being placed down. Section 19 is the development of an area near Otto Lake. It's almost 30 acres, and the person who is developing the property, Alaska Tourism Development, has proposed spending $30 million constructing a tourist lodge and associated resort facilities. Section 20 is the approval of a transfer of rural property to Neighbor Works Alaska, which is a housing nonprofit organization who would like to make improvements to their housing. However, they are having difficulty getting financing because it is a lease and they do not own title to the property, so they wish to purchase the property so they can make improvements and upgrades. Section 21 and 22 are approval of land sales in the Anchorage Terminal Reserve, which has not been solicited by the railroad. However, because of Senate Bill 86, we were contacted by Linden, and they have expressed an interest in negotiating with the railroad to buy the long-term leases that they have in the Anchorage Reserve. And with that, I'd be glad to answer questions.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Moss, the last sentence or couple sentences, did you say that one of the leasees is entertaining the option of buying the land they're using now in the railroad? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct.
In Anchorage?
In Anchorage.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Moss, by legislative approval, that does not mean we are not forcing the railroad into selling anything that they don't want to sell. Is that accurate?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions for committee members on the projects for proposal? Ms. Moss, is there, this is all of the pieces that were originally under discussion when the Railroad Corporation was asking for the, for not having to come back to the legislature to ask for these individual approvals. Are all the different parcels included here that we're aware of?
Madam Chair, yes, there are five parcels that the railroad was interested in negotiating sales for. The last three parcels are parcels that lessees have approached us about an interest to sell or to purchase.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Moss, the bill that we were looking at before had a three-year sunset. It would, I think what it had before was non-identification of exact parcels, and it was more of just get done what you can get done in 3 years. It seems to me what we've done is identified specific parcels, but have we put a three-year or some type of term on this or no?
Through the Chair, Senator, no, we have not put a limit on it. Most of these projects, five of these projects, have been in a long-term negotiation with the lessees, with the exception of Chena Landing, which there is not a lessee. That land is owned by the railroad, and they have subdivided it and developed it themselves. So they will be selling individual lots to private property owners.
Senator Von Imhoff, if I could set the stage a bit. The Senate, what passed out of the Senate is exactly what you said. We authorized a general purpose agreement, and we put parameters around that agreement that would have allowed the railroad to go forward and do their due diligence, make sure that it was in the best interest of the railroad and the state of Alaska, and that they would have 3 years to do a test run to see if they did what we expected of them for that best interest. The House did not accept that structure in their committees. The House wanted to stay with, and everyone that has testified can come back up and tell us if I've got this wrong, but in the House structure, they wanted to approve individual projects, and so in respect for their work, 119 is representing their structure and not what the Senate sent out in an effort to try to give consideration for the railroad to be able to go into these lease agreements. And as I said, a bit of a Christmas tree coming together with other projects around the state that are trying for development to do other things as well. Ms. Moss, did I get that right?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I did want to emphasize Julie Luckey's testimony that what this bill also does is it retains provisions in the Senate version that eliminates some of the bonding authority, improves a public notice, and seemed like there was one other thing that it did, but it retained some of the language in the Senate version of the bill.
Thank you. I believe what's there is the certified notification if you're an adjacent property owner to that. Senator Coghill, would you like to, I'm sorry I didn't see you in the audience, would you like to join us at the microphone, place your name on the record, any comments? Ms. Moss has done a great job in walking through the individual projects.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Coghill, Senate District B. Reneva certainly did an excellent job, has done the detail work. I just wanted to remind the committee that among the other things, we also still had the reporting mechanism that they would come back to the legislature and remind us of the process and how it came out.
Thank you, sir. Questions for either Senator Coghill or Ms. Moss? Thank you for presenting your portion of the bill before us. Last but certainly not least, for packages that have arrived today, Representative Cobb. Your name for the record, and if you could point us to the sections in the new CS in front of us that affect your interest in the bill before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Chuck Kopp, District 24 in Anchorage. Madam Chair, the sections of the bill are sections 4 and 6. To lay the foundation for this, Madam Chair, 2 years ago, I became aware in June of 2016, that there was some contested land use issues involving the railroad right-of-way that extended from the Fairbanks area going all the way down to Seward. and these were all focused on sections of the right-of-way that had to do with homestead patent properties. Properties that had gone from the federal government when we were a territory into state hands prior to transfer of the federal land, federal railroad into state hands in 1982. Madam Chair, the questions were raised because landowners in 2012 started receiving bills, invoices for sections of their lawn and gardens that were in the right-of-way. And they questioned that because they had been on these homestead patent properties for 40 or 50 years, either as the original homesteader or as a successor in interest, and their homestead patents showed the railroad was reserved a surface easement, a right-of-way for rail, telegraph, and telephone, but nothing more, with their homestead being on both sides of the tracks. There wasn't two homesteads with the fee simple interest in between. It was one homestead. So they came to me because this affected South Anchorage, Midtown Anchorage, and going all the way up through Eagle River in the valley. And they said, why are we getting these bills? So we did some research legally, went to the railroad, and there was a lot of back and forth, and the railroad agreed that possibly that was legally shaky. So they stopped what was called the Residential Right-of-Way Use Permit Program, where they stopped invoicing people for a lawn or a garden that was in the right-of-way. But, Madam Chair, what we realized in continuing to research this is that there was no long-term legislative oversight to say that the railroad should not claim an interest in the right-of-way if the federal government never owned that interest to give to the state in the first place. In researching this with the public lands lawyers with our congressional delegation, Senator Sullivan's office, Senator Murkowski, and Congressman Don Young, we received this letter, which the committee members have, which highlights their legal opinion that we were exactly right to be trying to pursue a correction from what the congressman here says was a clear direction from Congress to dutifully recognize basic tenets of due process. And unfortunately, he says there's been a failure by the agencies, which has resulted in a cloud on title of the neighbors along the right-of-way. Congressman Young said there is no way a bill quietly annexing private property rights, especially without any notice or compensation, would have passed Congress in 1982. He says if the federal government didn't own it, it was not included in the transfer. There is no canon of statutory construction or even common sense reading that would argue an unconstitutional taking of private property rights was the intent of Congress. Nowhere in the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act did Congress authorize the transfer of privately owned property interests, nor could it do so in such a cavalier and vague manner as is being suggested. So, Madam Chair, with this language here in Section 4, speaking to the amendments, the legal effect of these proposed amendments is simply to provide direction and clarification in our statute to prevent the railroad from exercising perceived authority to continue to acquire privately owned property interests in violation of federal and state law and our due process clauses. Now, what this would look like in practice, Madam Chair, is if a fence appeared across private property that would require a landowner to drive 20 miles to a public crossing just to get to the other side of their own lot. This, in fact, happened just north of Eagle River at the Latter-day Saints. They have 90-some acres there, and they are cut off from their own campground and lake from their main lodge when the railroad required them to build 500-foot fence on either side, then tear it down and reconstruct it further out, a higher fence costing the church over $100,000. They have an original homestead patent. It was always their understanding that it was their land, no contesting that it was the railroad right-of-way, but simply asked, let us use the land that we have had from the original homestead patent. So again, each amendment here has prospective application, Madam Chair, and no part will independently result in a change of ownership of any property interest. It won't independently operate to disclaim or restore any property rights. Again, it's direction. It says that no railroad property that was transferred from federal to state ownership will be affected by these amendments. The railroad simply is to not make a claim unless our title recording system shows that that claim was in the federal interest at the time it was transferred. In other words, the federal government owned it, and they can transfer it to the state. So the amendment at AS 4240-350 in Section 4 uses the phrase to not have authority over real property. The Railroad Corporation is given its authority to act in state law. This amendment clarifies that this authority does not include the ability to take action or otherwise manage property if it was unlawfully obtained. No determination as to what is lawful or unlawful is required for this direction to be appropriate from the legislature. And the amendment, Madam Chair, in Section 6 to 4240-410 uses the term conclusively owned. Real property is the most unique thing that can be owned, and each parcel is different. Each parcel comes with a unique history of ownership and use. And because direction in the amendments is to be employed in this infinite variety of settings and circumstances, some terms have to be left open to reasonable interpretation. To say conclusively owned is to say generally that any individual parcel's chain of title clearly demonstrates that the federal government was in fact the fee owner of the right title or interest at the time it was transferred to the state. So as stated by the Railroad Corporation, this will almost certainly be the case for the right-of-way that went across public lands. The right-of-way that goes across private property is where this direction from the legislature comes into play. So even so, each parcel in the right-of-way would need to be individually evaluated to determine what the federal government owned when it transferred the rail properties of the Alaska Railroad, which only included the right title and interest of the United States, what the United States owned. If during that analysis it becomes reasonably clear that the Railroad Corporation is only in possession of the federal interest in the parcel, what the federal government owned, then the amendments will have no effect. That concludes my testimony, Madam Chair.
Mr. Kropp, is the Railroad in favor of this amendment?
Madam Chair, the Railroad is not in favor of this amendment. It provides oversight that they are uncomfortable with. The Railroad admits that there is a strong legal argument in favor of this. They've seen the letter from our congressional delegation. It's uncomfortable to have legislative approval on this. The legislature is simply saying if you make a claim on private land, the title research should support that the federal government had it in the first place to give it to you.
Thank you, Representative Kropp. Do we have anyone from the Department of Law in the room? Representative Kropp, do you know if the Department of Law has the same interpretation of what you have conveyed to the Senate Finance Committee today? Do you have support from the administration?
Madam Chair, I have strong support from the administration. All the governor's appointees on the Railroad Commission support this, and also the third floor has assured me that they will support this language 100% as presented in this bill.
Mr. Peterson, are you available to come to the microphone and confirm or deny for the Senate Finance Committee the administration's position on the sections that are in front of us? You can stay.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Darwin Peterson, Legislative Director of the Office of the Governor. The Department of Law has reviewed the committee substitute that's before you. We do appreciate the work that the committee has done, and the administration does not have any opposition to the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Questions from committee members? Representative Kropp, thank you for joining us today in Senate Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, I'd like to open the public hearing on the Senate CS for the CS for House Bill 119, Finance. Is there anyone wishing to testify? Anyone off net or online? Anyone at all? With that, the public hearing is closed. Senator Bishop, are you prepared to cover the fiscal note?
Do my best, ma'am. Fiscal note, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. Allocation is the same. OMB component numbers 1, 2, 3, 4. The cost is zero. Under the analyses, the prediction of future market conditions, future actuarial estimates, or potential impairments and thereby their effect on ADA's dividend to the state of Alaska cannot be made. The second one is OMB component number 141. Apologize to my committee. Department of Education Early Development K-12 aid to school districts. Allocation is a foundation program. The cost is zero. The analyses is the funding mechanism is a general fund transfer to the public education fund. The fiscal note effect for 2018 to 2023 is reported in the fiscal note for the public education fund, as the funding is deposited into the public education fund and not into the foundation program. The above analysis is presented here for your explanation purposes only. Department number four is fund capitalization. Appropriation is the same, public education fund, and the OMB component is 2804. That is a zero fiscal note until 2020. Then $79,000 per year comes into effect under the optional exemption. Ketchikan Gateway Borough's annual required local contribution payment for the interest for the possessory. I almost did as good as the deputy commissioner. Interest value of the shipyard was $79,596. For 2017, for the purposes of this fiscal note, the $75,900 per year represents the current RLC, which may change in the future. If the bill, as amended, is adopted, the obligation for this funding for the Ketchikan Borough School District would shift and become the funding obligation of the State of Alaska under AS 1417-410 Public School Funding Program. Additionally, the statutory exemption for Red Dog Mine sunset is in November 2017. Under this bill, the exemption is retroactively applied back to November 30th, 2017. To continue the prior exemption with no fiscal impact to the state, it is understood that the exemption of the Alaska Ship and Dry Dock will begin in the calendar year 2018. There is a two-year lag in the assessed full and true values being applied to the public school formula under this AS 1417-410. The cost of the state would not be realized until fiscal year 2020, when it would be GF.
Are there questions on the fiscal note? Do senators need some time to go back to your offices and review any parts of the CS? Seeing and hearing none, are we ready to move the bill? Senator Bishop.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 119, version 30-GH1677/ uniform from committee with the accompanying fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, the Senate CS for the CS for House Bill number 119, finance version U, moves from committee with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations. Brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. We're back on the record. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Because of where we're at in this session, I am going to recess to the call of the chair. I do not expect us to be back tonight, so I don't expect staff to wait tonight, but to give us as much flexibility tomorrow morning as possible, we're just going to recess to the call of the chair, and I don't expect to be back here tonight. We will have a meeting scheduled for tomorrow at 11 a.m. It just depends how late we go tonight to finish things up. So we are recessed to the call of the chair.